You are listening to While We Were Sleeping. With us now is Jake Johnston, a senior researcher at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He is the author of Observing the Observers, the OAS in the 2019 Bolivian Elections, a report that debunks OAS allegations of fraud during the recent presidential election in Bolivia. Hi, Jake. If you could help us understand what happened in those elections last October.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here. So October 20th was the first round of the Bolivian election. I think it's important context. You know, there had been a lot of criticism over Evo Morales' decision to run for another term, and it was a highly polarized atmosphere. A number of members of the opposition very prominently said that they would not respect the result of the election if Morales did indeed win.
Hey. I'm interrupting Jake's response to provide more context. So, Evo Morales was running for his fourth term as president, defying a referendum against his re-election. But ultimately, he was running legally, after a controversial ruling of the Electoral Supreme Court allowed him to bypass the constitutional term limits.
Now, the Constitutional Court has nullified articles in the Constitution that prevent further re-election. It also ignores a referendum that last February narrowly voted to limit the number of times a president can serve consecutive terms.
Bolivia's president Evo Morales wants a fourth term in office. The Constitution says no. And last year, voters said no, upholding term limits in a referendum. But Morales and his party won't be deterred. They've sent a challenge to the Supreme Court.
And so the election was taking place in this environment. And on the evening of that Sunday, the Electoral Council announced preliminary results with about 84% of the votes counted. And it showed Evo Morales winning by about 7.5 percentage points. And this was just below the 10 percentage point threshold for winning in the first round. Now, after that, there was a suspension of the announcement of the preliminary results, and that system stopped reporting. The next day, when it began again, it showed Evo Morales passing the 10 percentage point threshold.
Which resulted in Evo Morales being re-elected as president. How was the OAS involved in what happened next?
That evening, and this is where the OAS role gets really important, that evening the OAS put out a press release decrying this inexplicable and drastic change in the trend of the vote from the previous day.
The Regional Election Monitor reported irregularities with October's voting results. Demonstrators accused Morales of rigging the last election and have staged multiple protests.
The Association of American States released a report saying the October 20th vote should be annulled due to alleged irregularities.
Now, it took us about 24 hours from that press release. We looked at the data ourselves and realized that actually these later counting votes were actually just coming from areas that had already shown a clear preference for Evo Morales. In other words, it was very much explainable.
On June 7, 2020, the New York Times acknowledged that the OAS statistical analysis was flawed. So, while the New York Times took almost 9 months to arrive at this conclusion, from what you have told us, it took your organization only 24 hours to check the data and conclude that there was no evidence of vote tampering in the results.
Yeah, I think this is extremely important point, right? So we were really a lone voice at the beginning of this in having a critique of what the OAS was saying. You know, major media in the U.S., in Bolivia, and across the world reported what the OAS was alleging as fact, that this was just simply true, without any word of skepticism or looking at the data themselves. And that was, again, we saw that perpetuated for months and months. And one of the reasons why that's so important, obviously, is what happened afterwards, which was on November 10th, when Evo Morales was ousted in a coup. Again, it was justified based on these allegations of electoral fraud and that the OAS had somehow confirmed these allegations of electoral fraud.
What was the OAS response when it was revealed that their analysis was wrong?
So basically, the OAS has responded to these recent reports from the New York Times and others by saying, well, the statistics are moot. That's not what determines if there's fraud or not. What we did in the report that you mentioned up top, Observing the Observers, was we took a detailed look at the rest of the allegations from the OAS. What we found was that it wasn't just the statistics that were deeply flawed from the OAS, but in fact, a number of their findings and most significant findings in their audit itself were contradicted by their own report, if you looked hard enough at it. Something like key pieces of information buried in footnotes in some of the last pages on the paper, or, you know, in the hundreds of pages of annexes, little pieces of information that directly contradict some of their conclusions.
Why do you believe the OAS acted in this way?
Often when these sorts of events occur, there's a confluence of factors, right? I mean, so when you look at the OAS role in this, you know, I think a key factor was that Luis Almagro, the Secretary General, was running for re-election himself.
In other news, the Organization of American States is preparing to choose its new Secretary General for the 2020-2025 period. The Permanent Council of the OAS met on Wednesday to receive the candidates.
The current Secretary General of the Organization of American States, Luis Almagro, was elected to a new five-year term today. The 56-year-old from Uruguay received the support of 23 of the OAS's 34 active members.
And his aggressive behavior and intervention in Bolivia's election was a message, a clear message to the right-wing governments in the region who he was courting in his re-election attempt. And so what we've seen is the Secretary General of the OAS really sort of cozy up to Trump in the United States and to Bolsonaro in Brazil, which together provide about 70% of the OAS's regular operating budget. So you've got this personal interest.
And what is the role of the United States in all of this?
From the U.S. perspective, I think it's clear this policy in Latin America has been sort of hijacked by the far right policymakers with a focus on Latin America, like Marco Rubio. And so what some reporting that we've seen since from the L.A. Times reports that the U.S. rep to the OAS, Carlos Trujillo, who is an acolyte and close ally of Marco Rubio, actually had steered the OAS observation mission into determining fraud, right? So again, I think you have to look at all of those motivations and factors that went into this initial lie.
Yeah, so if I have the facts right, Evo Morales resigned hours after the Bolivian military urged him to step down, and a day after the houses of his sister and important members of his party were burned down. Despite these events, there seems to be uncertainty about whether this was a coup or not. And I definitely sense your take on this, but if you can elaborate on it.
You know, what we see time and again throughout history, right, are in the moment, very few people are willing to denounce what is happening as a coup or as this undemocratic transfer of power. But over time, it becomes much clearer to a wider audience what has really happened. When you look at the events over the last months, right, I think there's really no other determination than what happened being a coup. I mean, you look at the tremendous pressure and threats that preceded Evo's resignation, but then also just look at the actions taken by the de facto government that resulted from Evo's departure and the steps that they've taken. And so I think you saw a similar debate in Honduras in 2009. You know, initially, even though it was denounced widely, there was a reticence to actually calling what had happened a coup. There are legal implications for that, including preventing the U.S. support for those coup governments. And so this becomes a key issue. Now, I think 10 years after the Honduran coup, it would be very difficult to find someone who would contest that that was, in fact, a coup. And I'd imagine that over time, it will become clearer and clearer to more people in academia and elsewhere just how much of a coup this was in Bolivia.
I know that after the coup in Honduras, violence in the country skyrocketed, and that to this day, it remains one of the most violent places in the world. This has had multi-generational impacts on the health and well-being of Hondurans. So in your opinion, how has what happened in Bolivia affected the daily lives of the people in the country?
Certainly. Well, I think, you know, what you've seen since the coup, right, is this real consolidation of a far right, you know, power base in Bolivia that has usurped power, obviously unelected. And, you know, it's no surprise that the communities that have had the worst impact from that are largely indigenous communities or areas with high support for Evo Morales and his MAS party, right, which have seen targeted repression by military forces with the backing of the coup government, of course. But I think this plays into so much more, right? I mean, we've seen that this is not just a caretaker government holding elections, but they're really dismantling state institutions and changing the foreign policy of the country. And I think that has tremendous implications, not just in terms of human rights, but also basic public services, you know, obviously super important in the current environment with the pandemic, you know, issues like access to health, access to social services, access to unemployment benefits, and these things, which the illegitimacy of the current government severely undermines those capacities of the state.
Delving into what you have said, The IMF has approved a loan to Bolivia of $327 million requested by the current government. Can you tell us more about the loan?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think there's more fine details of that agreement are still being worked out. There's certainly been some opposition within Bolivia to agreeing to this IMF loan or requesting it because of a long history of IMF conditionality, which has made sort of sovereign economic policy making much more difficult in Latin America, but across the world. I think one really amazing development in Bolivia over the last decade, right, has been the independence that they have gained from institutions like the IMF by building up their own international reserves and their own buffers in order to be able to respond to these crises. Now, unfortunately, I think, you know, what we've seen with the current government is much more of a return to those sort of neoliberal policies of the past that Bolivia had extricated itself from.
On Thursday, election officials postponed the election until October 18th.
The people are demonstrating, taking to the streets and calling for elections now because we are seeing the inability of this self-appointed president who is bankrupting the country.
Young people have called on us to go on a hunger strike until the government calls elections.
We no longer Originally, the interim government was expected to hold new elections in early 2020. However, they continued to postpone them despite the protests on the streets. The new date is October 18th. How do you see this process unfolding?
Yeah, I think this is obviously, you know, of critical importance. Ostensibly, Añez and this de facto regime that is in power today was there just as caretakers to hold new elections. Obviously, that is not at all what it has turned into. I think there are real concerns, not only over the fairness of a vote whenever it happens, given the militarization of the country, the repression of political opponents, the mass politicized arrests of activists and mosque leaders. So, of course, we've got a difficult, challenging environment. But beyond that, I mean, I think as these actors have gained power, they're increasingly resistant to giving that power up.
Sure, and with the candidate from Evo Morales' party, El Mas, leading in recent polls, there's a threat of another coup. Members of the interim government have spread the rumor that El Mas is trying to interfere with the current elections. It would be devastating for Bolivians if history repeats itself. Thank you, Jake.
All right, sure thing, Francesca.
This is something I thought you need to know. A recent study from Harvard Law School International Human Rights Clinic and the University Network for Human Rights determined that the month of the resignation of Evo Morales was the second deadliest month in terms of civilian death committed by state forces since Bolivia became a democracy nearly 40 years ago. Additionally, this study found that state officials, and I'm quoting here, have threatened journalists and shut down critical media outlets, arbitrarily arrested and tortured activists, and charged political opponents with vague crimes such as sedition and terrorism.
You have been listening to While We Were Sleeping. This episode wouldn't be possible without the help and support of Armando Ayala, Alex D'Alessio, and Beth Gilia. A special thanks to Jocelyn Caspa, who talked to us from Bolivia. Gracias, Jocelyn.
Mil gracias por compartir mi voz en otros países y gracias, ¿no?, por tomarme en cuenta.